Your speaker is Dr. Samuel Blumenfeld. Dr. Blumenfeld is an author of 6 books on education, some of which have been used extensively by homeschoolers. His latest book, The New Illiterates, focuses on the national reading problem. Dr. Blumenfeld has a BA from City College of New York and an honorary doctorate from Bob Jones University. He also publishes the monthly Blumenfeld Education Letter. This time I'll turn the podium over to Dr. Blumenfeld. Just on your microphone.
Thank you, Gary, very much for that kind introduction. Well, of course, it's a delight to be here with you to discuss a problem that all of us are so concerned about. Can you hear? Is everything all right? Of course, when I was going to school back in 1931, which gives you an idea of how old I am, you didn't have to worry about raising a literate child because the schools were doing a pretty good job in those days. These days they say if you want your child to become interested in books, you've got to read to the child, you've got to surround the child with books and do all kinds of things. Well, I came from an immigrant family. My mother was illiterate, so nobody read anything to me. And yet I was interested in books. I don't know, I guess it was sort of a natural thing. And I went to a school, public school in New York City, that knew how to teach children to read, and I learned to read very quickly and very nicely. And that was it. And of course, I think I probably had pro-literate intelligence. You know, they talk about the different intelligences these days, and I understand what they mean, because some people are born with tremendous athletic ability. Some are tremendous mechanics, they can do things with their hands, and others, of course, are more inclined toward the sedentary type of preoccupations, reading. If you're a good reader, you can become an editor, an ad man in an advertising company. There's many things you can do. You can become a publisher. So there are these so-called different intelligences, but everybody has to learn to read, no matter what it is you're going to do. Even if you're going to become a professional golfer, you still have to know how to read, you know. And it should be no big deal. It should be very simple, very easy, because we all have minds. We all have brains. And reading is simply a way of exercising the brain. And we live in a literate society, and of course, one thing we all have to be able to do is read the Bible. And so you have to be literate to be able to do that. So reading was never a problem in this country until the 1940s and 50s, when the educators changed the way reading is taught in American schools. They threw out the alphabetic phonics method, which is the proper way to teach children to read an alphabetic writing system, and they put in this new look, say, whole word or sight method that teaches children to read English as if it were Chinese, an ideographic or a logographic system, that is, characters. And the children are taught to recognize words as if they were Chinese characters. And of course, you can't learn to read that way. And so you ask yourself, why have the educators done this? And we see the results. We see widespread illiteracy in a nation that spends more money on education than any other nation, in a nation where more children spend more time in school than in any previous generation. More time in school, more money, where the teachers are supposedly better trained. Today's teachers not only have bachelor's degrees, they've got master's degrees, they've got PhDs. So why do we have declining literacy instead of increasing literacy? And I'll tell you, it's very simple. I'll explain it to you very simply. First, I'm going to define reading to you as given by Noah Webster. You've all heard of Noah Webster. He was the man who created the blue-backed speller and also the first American dictionary. He was a great lexicographer. And all you have to do is look up the word read in Noah's dictionary, Noah Webster's dictionary, and this is how he defines reading. Quote, read, to utter or pronounce written or printed words, letters or characters in the proper order, to repeat the names or utter the sounds customarily annexed to words, letters, or characters. Pretty simple, pretty understandable. In other words, what do we mean by reading? Well, supposing you were with a friend, and the friend got a letter from a third friend, and he was reading it, and you'd ask him, what does it say? What does it say? And the person would read it. This is what it says, you see. Well, now let me give you the definition of reading that is currently in use in the public schools of America. And this definition was written by professors of reading. This is what they say about reading. And of course, they call it now, the teaching method is called whole language. This is how they define reading. This is taken from a book entitled Whole Language, What's the Difference, published in 1991, so it's up to date. Quote, from a whole language perspective, reading and language use in general is a process of generating hypotheses in a meaning-making transaction in a socio-historical context. I'm sure you all got that. They're not finished yet. They go on. As a transactional process, reading is not a matter of getting the meaning from text, as if that meaning were in the text waiting to be decoded by the reader. Rather, reading is a matter of readers using the cues print provide and the knowledge they bring with them to construct a unique interpretation. Moreover, that interpretation is situated. Readers' creations, not retrievals of meaning with the text, vary depending on their purposes for reading and the expectations of others in the reading event. This view of reading implies that there is no single correct meaning for a given text, only plausible meanings, unquote. Well, what a difference between Noah Webster and these whole language gurus. Now, supposing, you know, here's... Well, we'll go back to that scene of the two friends reading a letter from a third friend. And so here's the second friend is reading the letter, and the first one says, I would like to engage in a meaning-making transaction and generate a hypothesis. And I would like you to create the meaning for me. Don't retrieve the meaning from the letter, but create your own interpretation. Does that make sense? Wouldn't you say that that is insane? The true definition of insane is unsound, unhealthy, illogical. This is quite illogical to tell children that this is the way they should read. No wonder we have a reading problem in America. And no wonder you've taken your kids out of the public schools. Because this is what's happening in the public schools, you see. And the children are faced with this. And what are their reactions? What is a child's reaction when he gets into a classroom and is told that reading is a meaning-making transaction in a socio-historical context? Well, that child gets a little upset, you see. That child gets upset because that child has come to school feeling very intelligent. And all of a sudden, that child feels very inadequate. Why is that child intelligent? Or how does that child know that he or she is intelligent? Because that child has taught himself to speak his own language all by himself. You know, every child is born with this innate language faculty. It's something we are born with. We are born with the ability to speak. Why? Well, God gave us that facility. God gave us the ability to speak for very good reasons. First of all, He made us in His image. And In the Bible it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So you identify God with the Word. And the human being is made in God's image, and he is given the power of speech. No other species has been given the power of speech. No other species. We have that power of speech. And it's very singular. It's species specific. No other species has the power of speech. So every child, every normal child learns to speak his or her language very nicely. And that child also has been born with software. See, we're programmed. If you want to compare us to the computer, this is the hardware, and the software is the programming. And part of that programming is grammar. The logic of grammar. Your children speak grammatically, don't they? They learn to speak grammatically quite normally and easily. Why? Because we are programmed to be logical human beings. That's the brain we're given, is a logical brain. And it's very interesting that one of the most important linguists in the world, a man by the name of Noam Chomsky, confirms this. As a matter of fact, Chomsky, who is an atheist, a socialist, God knows what else, he's very critical of the American system. Nevertheless, he puts great doubts into this business of language being an evolutionary development. Remember, Noah Webster was an Orthodox Christian who believed that language was a gift of God. Language was given to us. He believed in creation. Chomsky, although he's a scientist and in general believes in evolution, however, says that language is not a product of evolution. He says this quote, he says, "It is almost universally taken for granted that there exists a problem of explaining the evolution of human language from systems of animal communication. Human language appears to be a unique phenomenon without significant analog in the animal world. If this is so, it is quite senseless to raise the problem of explaining the evolution of human language from more primitive systems of communication that appear at lower levels of intellectual capacity." So even he says, hey, there's something wrong here. This quite doesn't work with this idea that human language developed from animal talk. It doesn't quite work out. He says, this poses a problem for the biologist, since, if true, it is an example of true emergence, the appearance of a qualitatively different phenomenon at a specific stage of complexity of organization. In fact, the processes by which the human mind achieved its present state of complexity and its particular form of innate organization are a total mystery. It's a total mystery. It's not a mystery to you and me. It wasn't a mystery to Noah Webster, but it's a mystery to Noam Chomsky and his fellow evolutionists. It's a mystery. But he then goes on to say, the human mind appears to consist of different systems, each intricate and highly specialized, with interactions of a kind that are largely fixed by our biological endowment. In these respects, it is like all other known biological systems, the physical organs of the body below the neck, for example. One of these systems is the human language faculty. It is particularly interesting because it is a common property of humans, with little, if any, variation apart from quite serious impairment. And it seems to be unique to the human species. Contrary to much mythology, other organisms appear to lack even the most rudimentary features of the human language faculty, a fact that has been shown quite dramatically in recent studies of apes. You know, the behaviorists try to show that the reason why apes can't speak is because they've been culturally deprived. And so they've actually had little monkeys living with human families thinking, well, if they're surrounded by speech, they'll somehow learn to speak. And of course, that's not the case. They did not learn to speak. And so he says, thus, human language appears to be a true species property and one that enters in a central way into our thought and understanding. So, why did God give man the power of speech? Well, there are four reasons. The first reason he gave man the power of speech was so that Adam could know his creator, could know God, because they conversed in the Garden of Eden, as you remember. The second reason that Adam was given speech was so that he could know reality. Remember, God brought all of the animals to him and said, name the animal. So Adam had to become an observer of objective reality, an observer of reality, and also a lexicographer. He had to begin naming all of these animals. So that was the second reason, to become an objective observer of reality. The third reason was to know others. God gave him Eve. And you know the business of communication between the sexes. So God gave Adam and Eve the ability to speak. And then, of course, the fourth reason is so that Adam could know himself, because what do we do with speech? We have this inner dialogue. We have this inner speech that goes on all of the time, where we're always asking questions of ourselves. So that's why language is so important, and that's why every child enters school feeling very, very intelligent, because they master language at that very early age. At these tiny tots are speaking perfect English by the time they're 5 or 6 years old, and they enter school and they feel so intelligent, and then they enter school and what happens? They're faced with this insanity, with this crazy new way of looking at reading. Now, how did this whole language business come about? Well, ours is an alphabetic writing system. Now, what is an alphabet? An alphabet is a set of the letters that stand for the irreducible speech sounds of the language. Now, where did the alphabet come from? Well, the alphabet was invented about 4,000 years ago, maybe 3,500 years ago. That's another mystery. Nobody knows exactly how or where the alphabet was invented. They have some theories in the Middle East and the Phoenicians or the Canaanites or whatever. All we know, though, is that the first important work using the alphabet was the Scripture. The Scripture, the Holy Scripture, is written in alphabetic writing. It's not written in hieroglyphics. It's not written in ideographs or logographs. It's written in alphabetic writing. As a matter of fact, it's interesting that when Moses went to the Mount Sinai to get the Ten Commandments, and God wrote the Ten Commandments with his finger, as you recall in the Bible, God wrote in alphabetic writing. Now, who taught God the alphabet? It's another one of these great mysteries, you see. In any case, the alphabet was invented then. Now, what were the methods of reading or writing prior to the invention of the alphabet? Well, the earliest, of course, you know, is pictographs. The cavemen drew pictures on the walls of their caves. The pictures looked like the things they represented. A tree looked like a tree. A human being looked like a human being. A bow and arrow looked like a bow and arrow. An animal looked like an animal. In other words, you didn't have to go to school to learn to read pictographs. Now, as civilization progressed, the scribes had to begin drawing pictures of things that did not lend themselves to depiction. I mean, how do you draw pictures of ideas, such as good and evil, right and wrong? Well, the scribes drew little images or characters, and they said, this stands for good and evil. They don't look like good and evil, but they stand for good and evil. And now you did have to go to school. Somebody had to tell you what all of these symbols stood for. And there were thousands and thousands of such symbols that were created by the scribes. And so you did have to go to school, and you spent years and years learning to read these ideographs. And then finally, somebody around, as I say, 2,000 years B.C., made a remarkable discovery. Somebody discovered that all of human language, everything we say is composed of a small number of irreducible speech sounds. And so that individual said to himself, instead of using this cumbersome system of ideographs comprising of thousands and thousands of symbols, none of which look like anything they represent and are easily forgotten, why don't I create a small set of symbols to stand for the irreducible speech sounds of the language, and then we will have a very simple and easy means of transcribing the spoken word into written form. Is there an Elaine Salisbury here? Okay. And he said, well, we'll have a very simple means of transcribing the spoken word directly into written form and an equally simple means of translating the written language back into its spoken form. And so the alphabet, first alphabet, was invented. Now, as I said, all of human language is composed of a small number of irreducible speech sounds. How many speech sounds do you think there are in the English language? Irreducible speech sounds. How many of them are there? Does anybody want to volunteer? Does anybody know? Yes. 74. Wow, you're way off base. Way off base. Yes, sir. No, that's too low. Yeah. Too low. 44, exactly right. You must have read my book. Yeah. Oh, you didn't? Okay. You see, now this is information that every one of you should have been given in kindergarten or first grade, that there are 44 sounds in the English language. Why weren't you given this simple information? You know why? They didn't want you to know. And I imagine most teachers don't even know that because they weren't taught it in their schools of education. So there are only 44 sounds in the English language, but there are 26 letters in our alphabet. How come? What happened? Well, what happened is this. You see, when the Romans conquered the British islands, they imposed the Latin alphabet on the people who lived there. Now, English is not Latin. English has many more sounds than Latin. And so what did the people there have to do? They had to adapt the Latin alphabet to English. Oh, God knows what they were speaking in those days, a kind of Anglo-Saxon or whatever. Which means that some of your letters are going to have to stand for more than one sound, and some of your sounds are going to have to be represented by more than one letter. For example, the letter A stands for at least four different sounds. It stands for the long A as in apron or April. It stands for the short A, the A, as in cat or bat. It stands for the ah sound as in father and car, and it stands for the or sound as in all or ball. So how does a child know which sound to articulate when he sees the letter A? Well, if you teach the letter sounds in their spelling families, the children learn very nicely which sound to articulate because they've learned the spelling family. We also use two letters to stand for one sound. For example, our typically English is represented by TH, the SH is represented by SH, the CH is represented by CH. We even have a sound in English for which we don't have any symbol, any letter. You've heard the sound ZH in leisure, pleasure. What's the spelling for ZH? There isn't any. So what we do is we have SU and pleasure, leisure. That's how we do it. We use the spelling form, you see. These are a few of the anomalies of our English alphabetic system. Now, how do you teach a child to read an alphabetic writing system? Well, every alphabetic system must be taught in the same way because they're based on the same principle. The principle that the letters stand for sounds. And how is that done? Well, the first thing you do is teach the child to recognize the alphabet letters. Doesn't matter which alphabet you're talking about. The Cyrillic Russian alphabet, the Hebrew alphabet, the Greek alphabet, the English alphabet. The kids have to know their ABCs. And that's easy enough to do. That's no big deal. Kids learn the alphabet very nicely with the alphabet song. You've all heard the song, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, X, Y, Z. There's another version which says W, X, Y, and Z. There is no such letter as and Z. And what they do is they steal a syllable from W. They say W, X, Y, and Z. It's W, X, Y, Z. So give that syllable back to W and get rid of the and. Yeah. Very simple to do. Well, anyway, kids learn that very nicely. The second step is to teach the child the sounds that the letters stand for. And first you teach them in isolation. Just tell them, like, the B stands for B, the M stands for M, you know, the C stands for S, and also K. And you give them the, you know, tell them when to articulate the particular letter in its particular spelling form. And then what they've done throughout history, in virtually every alphabetic system, is they would drill the child in the constant vowel combination. And if you look at the old primers that were published in this country in the 1840s and the 1830s, etc., you'll see they were drilled in day, be, by, bo, bu, may, me, my, mo, mu, ab, eb, ib, ob, ub, am, im, om. The purpose of the drill was to make sure that the child developed an automatic association between letters and sounds so that the child would develop a phonetic reflex. A phonetic reflex. What's a phonetic reflex? It means looking at the letters and hearing the sounds. It's automatic. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to look and say, now what does that stand for? B-A-B-A. You see, B-A-B-A. You see, in other words, they see it, and it's in syllabic form. The reason why they did it in syllabic form was because basically we read multisyllabic words in syllabic form. We break up the words into syllables, and we say them in syllables. And so, very easy to do. And once the child developed that automatic association between letters and sounds, then they taught words and little sentences and phrases, etc., and the child was on his or her way. And reading became very easy because it was automatic. The child developed an automatic reflex. And we had very high literacy in this country when reading was taught that way. Well, now with this new method of teaching reading, how do they teach reading in this nonsensical, insane way that I described to you earlier? Well, they teach the child strategies. Strategies, you see. Well, they do teach the alphabet. You know, they know they have to do that or else parents would really get upset. But beyond that, then they teach, what are the strategies they teach? Well, configuration clues. We'll put a little frame around the word because they want the child to see the whole word. They want the child to see the word as a picture. In other words, when they introduce the word horse, they put a little frame around it. See, the H goes up, and then you've got this little frame around the word. You see the horse, see the neck and the body, you see the picture of the horse. And then that's so they have that configuration cue or clue. Some call them clues, some call them cues. The second strategy is the picture cue or clue. In other words, they'll have pictures of horses on the page when they introduce the word horse. So the child will associate, see, that word must say horse because I've got so many horses on this page. But then they can't always have pictures of horses when they're using that, you know, because they might, may have some other things they've got to illustrate. So they use what they call context cues or clues. The sentence will be like, the man put the saddle on the, and the child will read the word and say, pony. And the teacher will say, wonderful, you're seeing the picture, you're seeing a four-legged animal. They call that word substitutions, and that's okay. Kids can substitute any word they want, you know, as long as they think it makes sense. Well, it could be pony, it could be foal, it could be mare, could be colt. See, there are no limits to word substitutions. And then finally, they do teach phonetic clues or cues. Now, why? Because they don't want to be accused of not teaching phonics. You see, so they have to be able to tell you that they do teach phonics. Now, that's not intensive systematic phonics. That's incidental phonics. That's phonics just thrown in as a last resort. Phonics, which is then parked up here, stored in the attic, and maybe used, maybe not used, but since it's not automatic, it probably won't be used. See, phonics that is not automatized is rarely used. Why? Because the child doesn't want to stop and draw out some of the phonetic knowledge that he or she may have. They want to keep reading, so they'll substitute words, they'll skip words, they'll put in words that aren't there, they'll leave out words that are there. I mean, I've done a lot of tutoring of functional illiterates and children with reading problems, and that's the way these kids, these look-say readers read. You know, they're reading along at a nice pace, but you notice that they're leaving out a word that's there, they're putting in a word that isn't there, they're skipping words, they're guessing at words, they're mutilating words. And the educators think that's fine. They think that's fine, that's wonderful. And so they're producing all of these kids who come out of school and who have reading skills that are in the pits. And they feel they've done such a wonderful job. They don't know why parents are complaining. They don't believe there's a reading problem. Oh, that's just propaganda in the newspapers, you see. But it's interesting that the Department of Education, 2 years ago, September, came out with the results of its survey of adult illiteracy, in which it was found that 50% of the adults in this country have reading skills so poor that they might as well be considered functionally illiterate. 90 million adult Americans, all of whom have spent more time in school than any previous generation, more money was spent on their education, their teachers were supposedly better educated than ever before. Why can't they read? The reason why they can't is because they have developed a holistic reflex. A holistic reflex as opposed to a phonetic reflex. Now, when you develop a holistic reflex, you automatically create a barrier or a blockage against seeing our words phonetically, seeing the phonetic structure of our words. Most of the kids haven't been drilled in the sounds. Yeah, they have some letter sounds up there in their attic, but they don't use those. They don't use that knowledge because it isn't automatic. They have an automatic way of looking at words holistically, and that creates dyslexia. In other words, the schools now are deliberately creating dyslexia among thousands and thousands, if not millions, of children in the schools. And of course, I hear about this all the time with parents coming to me with all kinds of, or phoning me with, telling me about the sorry plight of their child who's in the third grade and can't read, and is, you know, in a very bad state. Ingram? Laurie Ingram. Is there a Laurie Ingram here? Okay. All right. So the schools are doing this. And so your only guarantee that you have that your child will be able to learn to read is to do it at home. You've got to do it at home. You have no other recourse. If you're going to rely on the schools, chances are that your child will become learning disabled. Now, there are a lot of parents who teach their children to read before they get to school. But you see what happens is that child will then go into a whole language class and will become thoroughly confused and will unlearn what the parent taught. Why? Because what the parent taught had not yet become automatic. See, a child who develops a phonetic reflex will never get dyslexia. Because it's now automatic. It's set. You see, like any reflex, it's set. And so that child will never look at words, you know, as being little pictures. It would never occur to that child to look at words that way. It would just be impossible to look at words that way. You see, you can't, when you have these competing reflexes, only one can prevail. One reflex at a time can prevail. Now, how do you undo a holistic reflex? Well, that's what I specialize in. And the first thing I do is I test the kids with my oral reading assessment test. And that way I can see to what extent the child has this phonetic deficiency and then what has to be done. Because when you want to tutor somebody, you want to find out immediately what their state is, their reading level and all of that. And usually that's it, that they have a very, very poor grounding in the phonetics of their English alphabetic system. And so what I do is then I take the Alpha Phonics book and I teach them the entire alphabetic system from beginning to end. And I do it in this book. All of the instructions are in the back. It tells you how to teach it. Now, the interesting thing about this book is you'll see there are no pictures. I've never had a child or anybody ask for pictures. Why? You don't need pictures. These are sound symbols. I mean, A does not stand for, an apple does not stand for A, you see. Pictures are a distraction, and you find that you don't need the pictures. And I go through the entire alphabetic system, and I've arranged this whole system as logically as possible. Why? Because the brain is logical. You see, so you want to use logic to teach a child to read, the same logic that is in the child's software, so that you don't have a misengagement. You don't have gears that are grinding against one another. You've got gears that are fitting very nicely, and this works very nicely. First, I start with the short A, the A. You teach the consonants with the short A. Then I teach the rest of the short vowels, the A, E, I, A, U. Then we go into the blends, the consonant blends. And then finally, we take up the long vowels. And the reason why we put the long vowels at the end is because in our English system, we have many different ways of spelling the same sound. Take, for example, long A. The most common way that we write long A in English is A consonant E, as in eight, A-T-E, age, A-G-E, bale, B-A-L-E. But that's not the only way we write long A in English. We write also A-I. We use A-I as in Main, Main Street, M-A-I-N. Then we also use A-Y, as in day, D-A-Y. Then we also use E-Y, as in obey, O-B-E-Y. And yet the E-Y stands for A, and there isn't an A in sight. And then we even use E-I-G-H to stand for A, as in eight, or wait. E-I-G-H, those four letters together stand for one sound. It's a spelling form. Why do we have all of these spelling forms? Because we have many words in English that sound alike but have different meanings. We've got Main and Main. The horse is Main and Main Street. You've got 8 and 8. I ate lunch. I'll meet you at 8. The minute you see, if I just said the word 8, you would ask, well, which 8 do you mean? But if you saw, if I wrote it, you would, if and I wrote A-T-E, you'd know what I meant. If I wrote E-I-G-H-T, you'd know that I was referring to the number. That's why spelling is so important in English. Now, what are they doing in whole language? They're teaching invented spelling. You see, that's going to destroy every child's ability to learn to spell. Why do we have to invent spelling when Noah Webster compiled the dictionary for us? The words, we have a standard spellings now. Kids don't have to invent any spelling. And yet this is what they're doing. And they have the kids writing before they even know how to hold a pen, before they know how to form the letters, before they know how to spell. And what is the rationale for this? Oh, well, we don't want to hinder the child's creativity. Yeah, we'll let the child develop all of these horrible habits, these bad habits, just as long as he can be creative. Well, I don't think that learning to spell correctly ever hindered anyone's creativity. I think it probably enhanced it. You know, it does just the opposite. But the educators are doing everything in reverse. Take, for example, the way you teach writing. Now, writing should go along with reading. Now, when I was going to school, back in the 1930s, we were all taught cursive first. We didn't learn to print. We didn't go this business of ball and stick, straight lines and perfect little circles. That was ridiculous. We learned cursive. Our hands were just, you know, we did all those curves and wonderful things that kids want to do. We learned cursive in the first grade. And you know that learning cursive helped us learn to read?
Please turn tape now for side two.
Parents often ask me, well, aren't they reading print? Shouldn't they write print? And I say, no. They're reading print, but they're writing cursive. Well, won't they be confused? No. My generation and all of those that preceded me learned it that way, and none of us were confused. Now, why does cursive help a child learn to read? Well, you know, one of the big problems that kids have with ball and stick is that the letters look alike. B's and D's, F's, T's, you know, F's and T's, P's and G's and Q's look alike. But if you write cursive, they're quite different. For example, if you write a B in cursive, it starts like an L. It goes up and around like that. If you write a D in cursive, it starts like an A, you see. And the child never will confuse a cursive B with a cursive D or a cursive F and a cursive T. Never confuse them. And so when the child is writing cursively, that knowledge from the hand is transferred to the eye in reading and helps in reading. And also the fact that the letters are linked together in cursive is also a help to reading the words in their proper sequence, the letters in their proper sequence. Because as you know, when children are printing using ball and stick, the letters are all over the place. Not only are the letters all over the place, you don't know where one word ends and the next word begins. And also, some of the kids will write the letters backwards, won't they? But you can't do that in cursive. You can't write backwards in cursive. You've got to write from the beginning to the end, and the sequence is there. And sequencing is very important in learning to read. And also, the eye is trained then to look at the letters, to make sure that the letters are in the proper sequence. Proper sequence is very important. As Noah Webster said in his definition of reading, what does he say? He says, to utter or pronounce written or printed words, letters, or characters in the proper order. The proper order, you see. Which doesn't apply in whole language. See, now the human mind, we are born with an innate universal grammar. Proper order of words, proper construction of sentences. And yet the whole language people do it just the opposite. Why? Because they want to confuse the brain. They want that child's logical brain to become illogical. Now, some kids don't like what's happening to them in the classroom. They've got this logical brain, and they don't like what's being done to it. So how do they defend themselves? How do they defend themselves against the illogic of a teaching method that's being used in the school? You know what they do? They don't pay attention. And what do they call that? ADD. So ADD is actually a consequence of the insanity going on in the school. The kids are trying to defend themselves. They're forced to sit in the classroom. And the only defense they have is either to shut the nonsense out or to act up, become little monkeys in the classroom, jump all over the place, make themselves obnoxious so that they'll get thrown out, which is what they want. They want to get out of there. I mean, what would you do? Think of yourself as an adult. Supposing you were trapped in a room where they were blaring heavy metal music at high decibels, and you were forced to stay in that room for 6 hours and endure that. What would you do? You'd want to plug up your ears. you divert your mind, you would do everything possible to lessen the effects of this on your brain. Now, some people would not fight it. They would accept it. And what do you think they'd be like when they got out of that room? They'd be completely changed, wouldn't they? Their tastes, everything about them would be changed. Well, it's the same with some children in the classroom. Some children are so anxious to please the teacher that they will accept any insanity and adapt themselves to it so that they come out and you can't recognize these children as human beings any longer. That's what's happening to many children in our schools. If you subject them to these kinds of teaching methods, you're going to get that kind of result. So you as parents have got to teach your children to read at home in the proper way. And then just teaching them phonics is not enough to make sure that they become literate human beings. What do I mean by a literate human being? I mean a person who finds reading easy, delightful, wonderful, they enjoy it. The entire world of the written word is open to them. The whole library is theirs to claim as their inheritance. That's what a literate human being is able to do. A literate human being is able to read, to listen to the words of the past, to listen to authors who are long gone, human beings who are no longer with us, but their wisdom comes to us through their written words, because their written words are really recordings. They are written recordings of sounds of their voices. And so when you sit in a room and you're reading something written by somebody who has been dead for 200 years, you are actually hearing their voice. And they're speaking to you in their language. And that's the beauty of being a literate human being and being able to appreciate the written word. Now, of course, so what does that mean? It means you've also got to help your child develop vocabulary. How do you do that? The easiest way is to give them books or get them interested in books that have rich vocabulary. For example, Dickens, Edgar Allan Poe, other American writers who have rich vocabulary. I like to go back to the older books. Today's novels, you'll find that the most popular novels today are written at a Dick and Jane level. Short words, short sentences, he said, she said, you know, pow, you know, words like that. Bang, bang, you know, really difficult vocabulary. Well, that's what people can read these days. They've been trained, you know, they're monosyllabic in their abilities, except the few words, you know, like dinosaur. Every child can read, you know, Tyrannosaurus. They can't read anything else, but they can recognize Tyrannosaurus because it's a sight word. It's a sight word. They've memorized the word as a little picture. But you want your child to be able to read anything. And so you want to help develop that child's vocabulary. And the way you do it is to give them books with rich vocabulary to read. And that, of course, another important thing, of course, is have them write and to copy. You want to make sure that they're learning to spell correctly. Let them do a lot of copying. Let them copy the Declaration of Independence. It's not a bad exercise. Let them copy good poetry. Poetry is extremely helpful in learning to read and becoming a literate human being. Now, of course, we've got this television problem. TV or not TV? That is the question. And it's a difficult question for a lot of families. What I would say is you've got to restrict your children's viewing of television. Let them look, get a video that you consider worth while, but don't let them just turn it on and become these passive couch potatoes at an early age. You want to make sure that their minds are active when they're reading, you see. Their minds are being used when they're reading, but when they're watching television, they're lying back and being acted on, you see. So you've got to definitely work on that. You know, things have changed since the early days when the main means of entertainment was reading. But you'd be surprised how many kids love to read, how many kids get
hooked on these series books, you know, the Nancy Drews and the Hardy Boys, and that's wonderful. And they can go through these books at an incredible speed, and it gives them the reading habit. They enjoy it. It's easy. You can always tell a sight reader, a holistic reader, by the fact that they hate to read. They only read when they absolutely have to. They don't read voluntarily. They don't enjoy it. They don't like it. Why? Because it conjures up the pain that they went through in that classroom. And they hate reading. And what a terrible tragedy that is to inflict that on children. So the most important thing for you to do, of course, is to teach your child to read correctly. I highly recommend the Alpha Phonics book because it's logical, it's simple, it's all in one book, easy to use, and it teaches spelling families, teaches all the sounds of the language, and then, of course, they go on from there, and they do usually very well, and they enjoy reading, and it becomes a lifelong enhancement. Becoming literate is like having another sense. Another sense. A sense that, and also like having a time machine that can take you back. A time machine that permits you to go back into history, to read the biographies, the journals of people who lived years ago. And why is it important to read biographies, the lives, the life stories of those who lived before us? You know why? Because they went through it all. You could see their entire story. What are the mistakes they made? What were the prices that they had to pay for their mistakes? You see. And then you want to read the biographies of great human beings who overcame, you know, incredible obstacles. You want to read history. All of that is available to you if you're literate. And that's why it's so important for individuals, for your children to become literate human beings in a society that's becoming more and more illiterate. Remember, 85% of the children in this country are still going to these public schools, are being taught to read by this ridiculous method that I told you about. They're going to be the illiterates of tomorrow, and your children are going to have a tremendous advantage in the fact that they can read, that they're literate. So it's up to you. Now, we have about 5 minutes, so what I will do is take if there are any questions that you want to raise. Yes, sir. Yes. The question is, at what point should you start teaching writing in conjunction with the reading? And I would say, generally at the very beginning, when you're beginning to teach the letter sounds, and particularly when they start reading words, then you want them to be able to write the word. So writing takes a little longer to learn than reading. Writing is slower to learn, particularly cursive, because you want them to form the letters correctly. You want to teach them to hold the pen correctly because it's the simplest thing to do. I mean, if you're going to use 4 fingers, you're going to get tired, you're going to get a cramp. But if you hold the pen correctly with the 3 fingers, you'll never get a cramp. Now, I've been writing for years, and I've never, ever tired. My hand has never gotten tired because I'm not using more than I have to. And it's a very relaxed kind of writing. You see, if a child is learning ball and stick, they're writing straight up and down. They're pressing very hard on the page, enormous pressure. And then if they switch over to cursive 2 years later, you tell them, hey, relax, relax your hand. Tilt the paper, or you tilt it this way. You tilt it counterclockwise if you're right-handed. How many people here have left-handed children? Well, cursive is also very important for left-handed children. You know why? If a left-handed child is taught print first, they will tend to hook. They will tend to hook so that they can see what they're doing. But if they're taught cursive first and the paper is tilted to the right clockwise, they cannot hook. They must write from the bottom up, And you will find that left-handed children are just as capable of developing a good cursive script as any right-handed person, sometimes better. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
The importance of learning to make sure your child holds the pen correctly, because once they get hooked on four fingers or five fingers or use, you know, the muscular dystrophy hold, it gets very, it's hard to break such bad habits. Yes, ma'am. Here's a child who can read well at 12 years old but can't read cursive writing. Well, if they haven't written, they haven't learned how to write cursively, have they? Well, can he write his own, can he read his own cursive writing? Well, I would have to know more about that particular problem before I could comment on it. This whole business of comprehension, you know. Right. You mean you've written a simple message to him in cursive and he can't read your cursive writing? Well, if he can't read your cursive oh, he can't decipher? I'd have to know more about that youngster. That's hard for me to answer right here. Yes, ma'am. Yes, that we have cases like that of children who can read well, but because of the way they were taught spelling are terrible spellers. But the only remediation for that kind of a problem is to have that individual do a lot of copying of correct texts so they get used to forming the letters in the proper sequence, you see. That's the only cure I know of for that kind of spelling problem. Yes, sir. Well, you tell the child, and now we're going to learn to write like a grown-up. You know, the problem with this business of learning print first is that some kids, by the time they get to the third grade, say, I'm not going to change the way I write. I'm going to print for the rest of my life. Some children then adapt themselves, so they create a hybrid, part print, part cursive. A lot of people write that way. And some kids develop a good cursive. You know why? Because they've been secretly, you know, practicing it without their parents knowing or the teacher knowing, because they always wanted to write cursive. They're the ones who write beautifully despite the print business. Yes, ma'am. Well, yes. I'm not saying, you know, there's only one way to teach phonics. There is, you know, there are a dozen phonics programs out there in the marketplace. Yeah, there are some people who can master the system, but somehow they have an innate phonemic, phonological awareness. They call it phonological awareness. But let me give you an example of a youngster that I've been tutoring. This youngster was in the first grade in Concord, Massachusetts, in the Thoreau School. You know, people spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to live in Concord because of the good schools. Well, this youngster was becoming functionally illiterate. He was in big trouble because they were using whole language. And his mother asked me to tutor him. Well, I would say that this child, and I was, had no phonological awareness whatever. A year later, he is now an excellent reader. He's an excellent phonetic reader. In other words, the way he was taught sort of squelched whatever phonological awareness he had, you see. So I was able to bring it out, and it took a lot of work because getting him to focus on the letters was like pulling teeth. I mean, you know, he was squirming in the seat and looking up in the ceiling and doing all kinds of things, you know, but forcing him to focus on the letters, and when he would have problem reading, I'd say, spell it, spell it, spell the word. And it was difficult for him to even, you know, spell the word in proper sequence. But after, it finally worked, you see. Yes, ma'am. That's right. Yes, the sight reader is lost. As a matter of fact, a lady brought her daughter to me who's in college. She's a very good sight reader, but she lives in absolute terror of having to read something in public and not knowing a particular word. She has no means of taking a strange word and simply breaking it up into syllables and sounding it out. She can't do that because she was never taught it. But she had a photographic memory and was able to memorize lots of words, you see. So you must have that phonetic reflex if you're going to become a truly good reader and avoid having this anxiety about not being able to read a new word. Yes, sir. Yeah, you could use a blank notebook and let the child... When you're teaching a child cursive for the first time, they will usually make a big scrawl all over the place. But in a very relatively short period of time, they will gain greater control, you see. For example, this youngster that I was tutoring, he enjoys writing as tiny as he can, you know. He'll say, I'll write it so tiny you'll barely be able to read it. You have to take a magnifying glass. So, you know, who knows? Yes, ma'am. Pardon? Who developed the whole language approach was basically developed by two of America's leading teachers of reading, the Goodmans, Yetta and Kenneth Goodman, and Frank Smith, another whole language guru. And they have a vast following of teachers all over the country. Yes, ma'am. Well, that's what you've got to... Is the child, would you say, of normal intelligence? Does he have a speech problem? Well, then if I were you, I would drill him on the consonant-vowel combinations. Yes, I would persist. You've got to. You know, just stick to it. Yes. Yes. Well, I'll tell you, I made audio tapes to go with this book specifically for that problem, because I had parents coming to me saying, I'm not too sure about the sound. You know, I asked people, what's a short A? And they look at you. Ah? I said, no, that's not a short. What's a short E? They have no idea, you see, so... You've got to give them that additional information. So I do have audio tapes that go with Alpha Phonics to help parents hear the word sounds, letter sounds. Yes. No, it's something for that anybody can use if you want to test an older child. It's not for the very young who are starting to learn to read. It's for the older ones that you want to remediate. You want to find out where are they at this point. Yes, sir. Oh, there are two, as a matter of fact, there are two booths that are selling my books. There's the Backpack and the Elijah Company. The Backpack and the Elijah Company have these books, and you'll be able to get them there. Yes, ma'am. Is the lady in black there? Good. Well, get a blank notebook and let her just write. Writing should be her workbook. In other words, let her write the sentences, write the words, that sort of thing. There are workbooks, and the Abeka Company has great workbooks if you want workbooks. Well, just use a good blank notebook. Get one from the University of Florida so that she'll, you know, really feel good on the cover. You have University of Florida. Yes, ma'am. We've had kids start as early as 3 and a half, but most kids, I would say, start at 5. You know, and depends on You know your child is ready to learn to read if they've learned the alphabet and tell you, Mommy, I want to learn to read. Then they're ready. Then you start teaching the letter sounds. Okay, one last question. Yes, ma'am. Generally, phonics will help a child with a speech problem improve their speech. It depends on what is the cause of the speech problem. You see, also you've got to look into that. For example, I tutored a young man for 10 years who had a very severe, he was a retarded, you'd call retarded or mentally challenged, whatever they want to call him these days. But he had an IQ of about 65. And I taught him to read by phonics, but still he would tend to want to read by sight. But every time he would look at a word and would substitute, I'd say, spell it. The minute I told him to spell the word, that would recall the phonetic knowledge, you see. Well, I want to thank you very much for your attention. God bless you all. Thank you. Sure.